Tonight, by asking you to brainstorm with me definitions for the word integrity. What does integrity mean? It's your chance to talk to me. What does integrity mean? What is it?
Initially, superficially, honesty.
Okay, that's what most people think of when they first think of hear the word. Okay. Anybody like to expound any further on that?
Doing the right thing when no one's watching.
Good. Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Okay.
Trustworthy.
Okay. Living in a trustworthy manner. All right.
Something about being a man of your word, a person of your word counted, and your yes was yes, and your no was no. So having a reputation of keeping your word.
Living true to your word. Yeah. Okay, very good. Someone with integrity treats all people fairly, no matter who they are, but it goes much deeper. People with integrity are whole. The way they talk about living life is the way they live life. Their beliefs determine their actions. One writer has said, choosing the right path, regardless of what others think or do. And I was thinking, consistent with what a pastor might say, biblical integrity. Sounds like something he would say. Biblical integrity, for me, is practicing the biblical lifestyle you preach. Choosing God's path, regardless of what others do or think. Staying true to your biblical beliefs and principles. And for me, maintaining integrity requires a deep trust in God and a patience with the unfolding of His plans. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. And we are going to cover 2 Samuel chapter 2, starting at verse 8, all the way through chapter 4, verse 12. We will not be looking at every one of those verses, although I will cover them. But we will talk about certain focal verses that I have passed out for you to read and share. So let me begin here and talk with you from 2 Samuel 2, 8 to 3, 5. About the strife between the houses of David and Saul. Where we left off last week, the tribe of Judah had made its choice. They wanted David to rule over them, chapter 2, verse 4. But Abner, Saul's military leader and relative, had other plans. Other ancient Near Eastern kings typically had their sons succeed them to the throne. And Abner believed that Israel should follow that same pattern. If David became king, the kingship would pass from Saul's family, and it would pass from the tribe of Benjamin, moreover, to the tribe of Judah. After the Philistines' victory, Abner took Ishbosheth, apparently Saul's oldest surviving son, across the Jordan to Mahanaim, which you can see on your map if you want to look. I'm sure Mary can give us directions there. And Mahanaim was also a Levitical city. It was a city of refuge. So it makes a certain amount of sense that Abner would place Ishbosheth there. And there, Abner anointed him king over the rest of Israel's tribes. So the stage was set for a bitter civil war that would last 2 years. And even after that war ended, David remained king at Hebron for another five. And by the way, it is Hebron. Someone asked me that last week. It's Hebron. So he stayed at Hebron another 5 years after the war ended before moving his capital to Jerusalem. After bringing the tribes together, the northern tribes, under Ishbosheth, Abner either wanted to bring Judah under his reign or at least limit David's influence to only Judah. So Abner marches his forces south to Gibeon, one of Benjamin's major cities close to the border with Judah. I don't think Gibeon's on your map. In response, Joab, who was David's nephew and his military leader, brought his forces and confronted Abner at the pool of Gibeon. Joab and Abner agreed to have 12 men from each side, 12 young men, fight in hand-to-hand combat. This was apparently viewed as a means of deciding an issue without embroiling the whole nation in a full-scale civil war. Didn't work, though. And the battle ended in a grisly stalemate with all 24 soldiers dead, and so it was indecisive. The two armies then fought, and Abner, in chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, was forced to retreat. Now, Joab had two brothers, Abishai and Asahel. And as Abner's forces retreated, Asahel, the younger brother, pursued Abner, focusing intently on running down and capturing or killing Ishbosheth's general. Abner warned the less experienced Asahel to stop pursuing him, but Asahel persisted. So finally, Abner killed Asahel, and by doing so, earned Joab, and I would add Abishai's, unrelenting hatred. Joab and Abishai continued to pursue Abner all the way to a place called the Hill of Amah, the precise location of which we do not know. And at that point, the men of Benjamin rally around Abner to stop Joab's advance. You'll find that in chapter 2, verses 18 through 25. At this point, it seemed like a bloody battle was imminent. So Abner warns Joab that continuing this fight would only result in Israelites killing other Israelites. So at this point, Joab apparently agrees, and he breaks off his pursuit of Abner's forces. So Joab's troops returned victorious from a battle in which almost 400 men had died, and I'll mention in a little while, most of those were Ishbosheth. Then after burying Asahel at Bethlehem, Abner and the army returned to Hebron in chapter 2, verses 26 to 32. However, the conflict had not really ended. Abner remained loyal to Ishbosheth until Ishbosheth one day accused him of having intimate relations with one of his father's concubines. Not a good idea. In a fit of anger, Abner left Ishbosheth's service and joined David and promised to bring Israel under David's rule. Joab, however, avenged his brother's death by killing Abner. David publicly mourns Abner's death, provides him with a state funeral, and orders Joab to participate in the funeral, which we're going to talk about in chapter 3, verses 6 through 39. And then after hearing of Abner's death, poor Ishbosheth feared for his life. Two of his own men ultimately murdered him and brought his head to David, thinking they'd be rewarded, which we're going to talk about, but David condemned them for having killed an innocent man and sentenced them to death. So in the midst of all this murder and intrigue, our theme today is how David retained his integrity. He refused to endorse underhanded efforts to establish the kingdom and continued waiting for God to bring him the kingdom. He mourned the death of Israel's leaders and sought to act justly in dealing with their murderers. Okay, that brings us up to where we want to start our focus today, 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 1. You got that, Cliff, I think.
The war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker.
After the men of Judah anointed David as their king, sporadic border fighting broke out between the house of Saul and the house of David. And these families both vied for control of the nation. Hostilities continued all throughout the two-year reign of Ishbosheth, chapter 2, verse 10. During the fighting, David grew stronger and stronger, as Cliff just read, and the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. In that conflict we just mentioned with between Joab and Abner, David's forces lost only 19 men, while Ishbosheth lost 360, chapter 2, verses 30 and 31. These results were typical of their battles. God blessed David with continuing military and political success. And he also blessed David with a growing family, which I just want to make note of for just a minute. So in chapter 3, verses 2 through 5, we find reference to David's family. His family grew significantly during his time at Hebron. In the months to come, we'll look at more of these incidences, okay? But David had taken four more wives besides Ahinoam and Abigail, both of whom are mentioned in 1 Samuel chapter 30, verse 5. One of these wives was named Maacah, 2 Samuel 3, verse 2, and she was the daughter of the king of Geshur, which was a province of Syria. This marriage was probably part of an alliance between Israel and Geshur, and shows us how David's power was extending northward. Three of David's sons, mentioned in chapter 3, verses 2 through 5, played important roles in the life of David's family. There was Amnon, David's firstborn, who you might recall later raped his half-sister Tamar and died at the hands of Absalom, Tamar's brother, who was David's thirdborn. Absalom then went on to make a play for the throne. It was almost successful, but in the end, he lost his life at the hands of Joab, David's general. Adonijah, David's fourth son, also made a play for the throne late in David's life, but David intervened and declared Solomon as his legitimate successor. And then Solomon later had Adonijah executed when he made a request that was interpreted as conspiracy. So back to our main line here. More and more northern Israelites recognized that David was God's choice for king and made him their choice. So note, for example, chapter 3, verse 17, where we're told that Abner conferred with the elders of Israel and said, "For some time, you have wanted to make David your king." Just wanted to make note of that as we pass. Even Abner knew that, you know, there was a lot of thought and talk about this going on, even though Abner had persisted in this civil war. Abner, you know, although maybe he didn't deserve to die as he did, as we're going to look at, Abner was not one of my favorite characters. Abner was a person who generally did things, you know, that he thought were in what I would call motivated self-interest. Okay? So, yeah, his desire, I think, was genuine to have David be king over the whole nation. But I don't think for a second that he didn't have his own interests in mind. Anyway, that's just opinion on my part. Throughout David's rise to power, he continually demonstrated patience and trust in God. When faced with opportunities to seize power by an underhanded means or method, he had the integrity to refuse, believing that God would fulfill his promise in his good and right time. And now, obviously, many Israelites noticed the integrity with which David acted and became convinced that they could have no better leader. So integrity is vital for successful leadership. Sometimes life situations tempt us to compromise our integrity and set aside our beliefs and our principles for personal advantage. And while these actions may bring immediate results that seem good, they don't bear long-term results that are desirable. So we need to demonstrate integrity in all situations as David did, and allow God to bring about his promises in his time and in his way. What we're going to do today as we look at each section that we're going to focus on is I've got a series of short case studies for you, kind of like we started last week, so you get used to that format. So here's our first one, and I'm going to share it. It's very brief, and then you respond. We have Lucas, who was a faithful employee. Lucas always gave an honest day's work and wanted the best possible results for his company. Eventually, he was selected to be a foreman. First, why is integrity an important factor in being successful in leading others?
A couple reasons. It sets an example, and two, you sort of attract what you are. You know, if you're a scumbag, you're probably not going to want to hang out with a guy that's full of integrity.
Okay. Right. It sets the tone, as you said, doesn't it, for how you expect people to behave and how they're going to represent you and whatever agency or business you represent. Okay? Other thoughts? Why integrity is an important factor in being successful in leading others?
You don't have skeletons in the closet. Okay.
Or if you do, you're honest about them.
As we have been inundated with in the last months.
Okay.
But that's just it. People of integrity don't have to deal with that. Yeah. They have led an honest life.
I've often thought that if somebody wanted to do that to me and drag out something from my distant past, I would just come out openly and be forthright about it.
Like Jimmy Carter? I've lusted after women.
Well,
that wasn't such a good idea, maybe?
So anyway, how do we demonstrate daily our integrity or our lack of integrity? Getting back on path here. How do we daily demonstrate our integrity or lack of integrity?
Well, when you ask the definitions or what people think of, I mean, being truthful, if you're known for telling the truth, well, first, you don't have to remember if you've told a lie and how to retell it, so you don't cross yourself up.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we're back to the honesty theme, okay? Yeah.
I'm looking for more.
That's up to you guys. How do we demonstrate daily our integrity or our lack of integrity?
Daily. In our lives. How do we demonstrate it? When you say you'll be home at 10 o'clock in the morning after coffee, you're going to be there, right? That's integrity.
Or at least calling your wife if you can't be there when you say.
Exactly. Yeah. All those things. If you expect her to have dinner on the table and she hasn't, a woman of integrity. We're going down a bad road there. No, but people of our work.
It's always a mystery.
You're just in troublemaking mode today, aren't you?
I am. But you see, the trust is there. The integrity in your lives is there so that those things are not troublesome to you. And that's what a life of integrity is.
You know what to expect from someone.
Yes.
They're not going to do off-the-wall things that will take you and whatever they represent by surprise.
For our pastors to know that they are men of integrity so that we can trust them with the mission that God's given them here, it's important to know that they are men of integrity. And we're assuming that the search committee asked all the questions.
Well, it might be easier to see if you look at it like, what if one of our pastors was not a person of integrity? How would that affect things?
Well, we've seen that in the past.
Eventually unwinds.
What?
It all eventually.
Yes.
Unwinds.
Sins will be found out.
So it is sort of critical.
Very critical.
Especially if it's critical not only in your own life, but if you are in a position of any, whether it's a business position or a church position, you.
All the more.
I have acquainted. My son works for Mesa PD, and I have a friend who works for Mesa PD as an officer, and it's very important that they live lives of integrity because what they do reflects on the organization. That was true when I worked for the state of Arizona. It's true for, and what we do reflects on our church family too, right?
Absolutely.
And on Christians as a whole and at large. How many times have we heard that, you know, is our enemy races to attack Christians who don't walk in integrity, and it can hamper our witness for Christ in many ways. All right. Chapter 3, verse 27.
Verse 27 says, "Now, when Abner had returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak to him privately, and there stabbed him in the stomach, so that he died for the blood of Asahel, his brother?"
Yes. Asahel. Okay. So here we're going to look at a lack of integrity. In an earlier battle, you recall, Abner had killed Asahel, Joab's brother, Joab was David's general. Abner, knowing he was a more skilled warrior, attempted to dissuade Asahel from chasing him, but when he did catch him, Abner killed him. But Asahel's death was not a murder. It was a tragedy of war. That's a difference, and it's a big difference. Joab, however, never forgot or forgave Abner. So when Abner transferred his allegiance to David and began to encourage the northern tribes to choose David as king, you'll find that in chapter 3, verses 17 to 21, Joab's anger heated up, okay? He had just, at this point, when he learned about this, we're told he just returned from a raid. So he goes to David, Joab, and he says, Abner only came to spy for Ish-bosheth. You don't trust him. You'll see that in verses 22 to 25. And just as a note here, he's telling David not to trust him, but I think David did, in fact, trust Abner's sincerity. He had not only prepared a feast for him, but in chapter 3, verses 13 to 16, he said, okay, we can do business here, but I need for you to return Saul's daughter, Michal, to me. And I just want to pause a moment and share some thoughts from Warren Wiersbe on that, because it roused my curiosity. You may have wondered, why did David make that a condition of covenanting with Abner and with Israel? And Wiersbe suggests that, first of all, she was still his wife, even though Saul had given her to another man, actually, someone named Paltiel. 10 years before, they had been wed, and Michal loved David very much, 1 Samuel 18:20, and we have reason to believe David loved her too. So it's good diplomacy to invite his queen to join with him, and the fact that she came from the house of Saul helped to strengthen their bonds of unity. By claiming the daughter of Saul, David is also claiming all the kingdom. And when Abner brought Michal to Hebron, it was a public announcement that he had broken with the house of Saul and was now allied with David. So, significant. So I think that David did trust Abner's sincerity at this point, whatever Abner's motives may have been. Joab, however, was, however you want to look at this, was blinded by hatred. Okay. Joab may have feared Abner might replace him as general over United Israel, but I think it's more likely that he couldn't tolerate the idea of David's befriending the man who had killed his brother Asahel. So Joab sent messengers to bring Abner to him, we're told in verse 26, without David's knowledge. One of those messengers may have been Joab's brother Abishai, because we note in chapter 3, verse 30, that Abishai, the scripture, holds him responsible for this murder as well as Joab. At this point, Abner is about a mile away northwest of Hebron at a place called the Well of Sirah, verse 26. So when they bring him back and Abner arrives in Hebron, Joab pretends to desire a private conversation with him. So he leads him aside into a chamber or a recess in the city gate. It's as if he said, Abner, step over here privately into my office so we can have a little chat about things. And there, as we read, he unexpectedly, from Abner's point of view, stabs him in the stomach and kills him. Joab believed that Abner's death served to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel. And you remember from the Old Testament that following a murder, the avenger of blood from the family of a victim would pursue the murderer and kill him, Numbers 35, 16 to 21. But that law didn't apply to Abner's case because he had not committed murder. Death in battle was not considered murder, and blood vengeance did not apply. So Joab here set aside God's law to destroy Abner. Abner had killed in war, but Joab had murdered. The point I want to bring out here is that a life of integrity allows no place for vengeance. As Christians, we can't claim to love God and others while planning to get even with someone who may have hurt us. And as difficult as forgiveness can be, living with Christian integrity demands that we see others as made in God's image and leave vengeance to God, Romans 12, 19. We certainly need to deal with criminals, but we need to do so as a society rather than as individual vigilantes. All right. Here's our next case study. The large truck slammed into the smaller car. This is kind of pointed because this kind of stuff happens all the time. The large truck slams into the smaller car. The family in the smaller car died instantly. The driver of the truck was not injured. The grandparents of the victims met with the truck driver to share their grief, but there were other family members who wanted vengeance. Who acted here with integrity? And what role does integrity play when we're tempted to avenge an action?
I think there's always a desire in those cases for justice. If that truck driver had done something that he shouldn't have done, but that's not the same, I think, as vengeance. It's a sense of, you know, reckoning for what you've done. And I have a similar case of a friend in Tucson, you know, his son was killed, ran into by a drunk driver going 80 miles an hour, and his son died in that tragedy. And there's a sense in which you want justice for that. But I don't think he sought vengeance, but he certainly wanted a chance, you know, some reckoning to that. So I don't know how you don't take it in your own hands, but there's a sense of they did wrong, there's a price to be paid.
Because there's accountability. Yeah. Someone has to be held accountable.
If you forgive, I know your friend, if you forgive the person who did this and caused the harm, is that necessarily at odds with holding that person responsible for their actions?
No.
Do you think it's part of Christian integrity to move toward that forgiveness?
I think it's a hard thing to do at times. It may take a lot of time. I was impressed with the group in Charleston. I think it was Charleston, the church where the pastor and a number of the people were killed in a Bible study by this guy. They all went and shared with this young man their forgiveness. They didn't stop the justice going on,
right,
but
they
acted in very wonderfully,
yes,
surprisingly, I think, amazingly Christian manner.
Yes. You may recall, oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You may recall in my book, in God's Arithmetic, in the chapter called High Def Pictures of God's Children, I have a story exactly like this from the shooting in Colorado. And there was a guy named Pierce O'Farrell who was shot twice, and he reached out in forgiveness to the shooter. And not, you know, some people mistook that for wanting him excused, the shooter excused from what he did, but that wasn't the case at all. He was evidencing God's love for this individual, despite what he had done, whereas there were other family members of people who were victims who wanted nothing. In fact, one guy's brother, one of the women who was killed, could not even go in the courtroom because he was afraid he would go up and strangle the guy. So there are different ways to react to these things. And what we're focusing on here is how, as believers, we can act with integrity in these situations. Okay.
I have that opportunity. Just a little story.
Okay.
To do that, and thanks to God, it was a great witness to friends and family of my faith and my integrity. The accident that took my husband's life, a woman about my own age, lost control of her car and caused his death. And I found out later, she lost all this I found out later, didn't know anything until later, until the attorneys had met and she just simply got pushed out of traffic and lost control of her car completely and killed my husband. So they went along and they handled all the insurance stuff as they needed to, and a lot of people in my family were very riled up about that. You know, lost it. And I, no. You know, the woman lost control of her car. It wasn't somebody on drugs. It wasn't somebody doing something they shouldn't, speeding. Who was in heavy traffic, and she simply lost control of her car. It could happen to anybody. And because my family was some of my extended family, not close family, but extended family, were rattling around about that, and they knew our attorney. I had to deal with this in a way that, they would understand, and it got to be, that was May, and it got to be heading towards Christmas, Thanksgiving time. And I had now had the woman's name and her address, and so I wrote her a Christmas card and told her that my husband knew the Lord and I knew where he was, and I'm not holding this against her in any way, and I hope that she's all right and her husband was in an intensive care for almost 2 months and was kind of back to where he was before he was very sick with cancer to begin with, but just told her that and told her that I was well taken care of and had family and friends around me, and I hope that she too was surrounded with family and friends as we go into this Christmas season. And I got, right before Christmas, I got a letter back from her, which I was actually afraid to open. I went and had coffee with a friend, and I picked it up in the mailbox as I was leaving, and I went, oh, I don't want to open this. You don't know, I don't know this woman from Adam. I didn't know anything about her, and I didn't know how she'd react to my, I'm not holding this against you sort of thing. Could have been someone who was inflamed. You never know. But it was a very sweet letter, just expressing that she couldn't go on now.
Mm. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, and so I was able to share the information of that with family, that this made a huge difference for her and for her husband and for how they were going forward in their family with this horrible thing that happened. And none of us were going to gain anything by being angry about it.
You never know what will happen with people. I came across an interview not long ago. You remember back long ago in New York, there was a killer named Son of Sam.
Oh, yeah.
Berkowitz, his last name.
Yeah.
He became a believer decades later. He's in prison, but he's a believer now and testifies wonderfully to the grace of God that saved him. And when you listen to him talk, he's like, the guy that did all those horrible things, he said, I don't even know who that was. He was a new person.
Right.
And you know, no one is beyond, reminds me how no one is beyond God's grace. And again, not to excuse the terrible things that happen and that people do and are responsible for. But it's amazing to think that God loves them.
Yeah.
That God loves even so-called worst of us, that he doesn't think there's anyone beyond redemption. That the Shack puts it in one line, God judges them worthy of love. And it's an amazing and a divine thing, for sure. All right, Jesse, let's look at our next set of verses.
331 and 32? Or do you
yeah.
want all, the other two as well?
Yeah, all of them. Mm-hmm.
Okay. 31 and 32, chapter 3. Then David said to Joab and to all the people who are with him, tear your clothes, gird yourselves with sackcloth, and mourn for Abner. And King David followed the coffin. So they buried Abner in Hebron. And Hebron? Is that the correct
place? Yeah, Hebron.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice and wept at the grave of Abner, and all the people wept. 36 and 37. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, since whatever the king did pleased all the people. For all the people and all Israel understood that day that it had not been the king's intent to kill Abner, the son of Ner.
Okay, thank you. So here we're going to look at the proof of David's integrity. In verse 31, David had accepted Abner's defection from Ishbosheth, and Abner was working actively to persuade the leaders of the northern tribes to accept David as Israel's king, chapter 3, verses 17 to 21. If the people in northern Israel, or for that matter in Judah, got the idea that David had conspired with Joab to kill Abner, their confidence in David would have been shattered. So when David learned of Joab's vengeance on Abner, he immediately made it plain that not only did he have nothing to do with it, but that he strongly disapproved of it, verses 28 and 29. So then David gave Abner, where we are here, David gave him a state funeral in which all the high-ranking members of David's court participated. David refused to allow Joab to celebrate his vengeful murder of Abner. In fact, he instructs Joab to follow appropriate mourning customs and to walk in mourning in front of Abner as they brought him to his tomb. Joab had to have followed these orders with his teeth clenched, you know, disgusted. Maybe he also felt humiliated by having to mourn publicly that I'm sure many people knew he hated. But full justice for Joab's crime was not meted out to him until much later. And I'm going to note here just in passing that by doing this, in a way, David was actually protecting Joab and Abishai. Because, you know, if it had become, you know, widely known that David was supporting murderers, that might not have gone well. So, again, in my opinion, I think this is one of David's ways of actually, you know, we see at the end of this chapter that David kind of talks to people in his inner circle, and he says, you know, I love these guys, Joab and Abishai, and they're so gifted, but oh my gosh, they are such a handful. They are so difficult. These sons of Zeruiah are too hard for me. You know, I can't control them. They're out of control. But so David had his hands full, but I think he acted in ways that somehow, whether Joab saw it or not, sort of protected him and maintained his dignity as well. So verse 32, David lays Abner to rest in Hebron and weeps aloud at the tomb. And we're told right before that David himself walked behind the bier and he mourned Abner with deep respect and genuine grief and laid him to rest. And so David continues to act with integrity and refuses to condone those who sought power through murder. One might expect in verse 32 a king to be more dignified, but David's weeping here demonstrates his loss. An enemy had become an ally and a friend, and God had been at work to reconcile his divided people, and Joab had in fact worked against that now. So David wept for what had been done. So here we come to verse 36. David had offered a brief lament mourning Abner's untimely and innocent death. And then we're told, like in verse 35, how he had then fasted for the remainder of the day. And, you know, God be do so to me and more if I don't, you know, not touch food until the sun goes down. So all the people, we're told, took note of this and were pleased with the way David reacted to Abner's death. The Israelites loyal to Ishbosheth might have thought that David had ordered or even approved Abner's death to weaken the northern tribes. And there might have been some people in Judah that concluded that David conspired to eliminate an exceptional warrior. But David's public grief at Abner's death and the honor he paid to him at his burial demonstrates to us emphatically that David continued to operate with integrity. So the people's verdict regarding David was that everything the king did pleased them. This is really important. The people recognized David's consistent godly lifestyle, and they realized that he consulted and obeyed God. They knew he was a person of integrity and one that they could hold as their king. So on that day, in verse 37, the Judeans and the northern Israelites knew that David had no part in the murder of Abner. Some Bible students think that David's motivation may have been partially political. And knowing God was leading him to become king, they thought maybe he wanted to broaden his power base by seeking to be a people pleaser rather than offend them. But I think that people can often see through an individual's false front to detect hidden political or social agendas. And had David's grief not been genuine, I think people soon would have noticed that and become reluctant to accept him as their future king. David's grief at Abner's death was consistent, recall, with his grief over the deaths of Saul and Jonathan. And so all the people of Judah and all the people of Israel at this point trusted David. Talk about our next case study. We have two men, Wayne and Jim, who were relatives and went into business together. Wayne experienced some personal financial difficulties and began to embezzle some of the profits that should have been used to maintain and expand the business. He was embezzling. By the time Jim discovered what Wayne was doing, the business failed. How might Jim demonstrate integrity now in his relationship with Wayne?
Maybe I missed it at the beginning. Are they both brothers?
They're related. That's all we know. Yeah. But even if they weren't, the same scenario applies. How might Jim demonstrate integrity with his relationship with Wayne, who had embezzled and taken their business down?
Hold him accountable.
Okay.
It's important. Hold him accountable. Obviously, it was discovered. So it's not like he has to go to him and say, well, what did you do?
Well, he's the other owner, obviously.
Right.
Jim's the other owner. So now, he's the one with the choice of how to proceed here.
Right. And he has to hold the other guy accountable.
Well, I'm assuming in this scenario that we're talking about believers. I suppose we should mention that, because I wouldn't expect the believer to act with biblical integrity. An unbeliever, I should say.
Yeah.
So let's assume that for the moment.
Well, that's why I asked if they were believers at the start, because the Bible...
Well, I thought you said brothers. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
I thought you said brothers, too.
Maybe I did. It was me. Just the Bible tells us not to take our brothers to court. You know, we're supposed to have a different relationship, how we solve problems. Or does it warn you don't take your brother to court for something, or they might take your cloak, too? I don't remember exactly.
Okay.
No, it's true. Yeah,
but,
that's right.
So.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be the same as holding him accountable, though.
Yeah.
So how would you do that in this case?
Not in court. And all you can do is make an attempt to let him straighten it out, to hold him accountable for it and make it good somehow. And if he refuses, here's where the difference between the believer and the unbeliever would come, I think, is that you have to let it go. You have to let it go then. I mean, you can do all kinds of things, take it to the church and all those things. The process that's laid out for dealing with someone who sins against you.
Well, it depends on whether he was repentant or not, I suppose. Yeah.
Right.
Depending on how Wayne responds.
In the end, you may have to let it go.
Yeah, and give it to the Lord.
Yeah.
You know, letting it go doesn't necessarily mean we're ignoring it. We can give those matters over to God.
Right, because God is going to... be the final judge of all this.
Yes, and if Wayne is indeed a believer, these actions, well, your actions are going to bear consequences regardless. But if you are a believer, depending on how Wayne responded to being appropriately confronted with integrity by Jim, we could have different outcomes going on. But I think you're correct. In the end, he's going to have to learn to forgive him.
Right. And just never go into business with him again.
Yeah.
A partnership is one of the most dangerous things to enter into.
Yes.
A business partnership.
Yes. I did have a good friend in Mesa when I was serving there with Cliff that Cliff would know if I mentioned. And he had that exact scenario, except the person wasn't a relative, a blood relative, but was a good friend. And the person took the business down with his spending. And he wound up, they gracefully parted ways. As far as I know, there was no bitterness involved, and my friend continued the business and made it, a success for as long as he could. Eventually, it didn't continue, but he continued it as long as he could and made it work, and they did part on good terms. So
you have to know a person really well to know if he's a person of integrity.
It's hard, yeah. It's
never allowed to enter into business with anyone
yeah.
who isn't a person of integrity.
Yeah. And which reminds me of slightly unrelated, but when the Bible talks about being unequally yoked, that doesn't always necessarily just apply to a husband and a wife. You could be talking about a business partner too.
Absolutely.
Or other scenarios where, you know, your goals, your purposes, your values, you're entering into a situation where you're already, you know, you have no common discourse.
You have a whole different paradigm, a whole different way you're coming at things, a biblical view versus a worldview.
Do you think that could apply to two people that are believers, but are one's very mature and one's very immature?
It could. It would require a good deal of discussion, preparation, wisdom to decide just how the extent of your involvement. One other thing coming to mind now, when selecting pastors, leaders for local churches, one of Paul's admonishments was that be careful that person is not a new believer.
Right.
Because if you appoint someone to that kind of position of leadership too soon, they can be subject to the temptations of our enemy and thus cause problems for the church. So
old people aren't subjected to temptation.
They are.
No.
But there are unique, there would be unique problems for a new believer to become a pastor right away without the proper preparation for it. And experience.
As an old person, they can look at my history and see how I did all along.
Yeah.
A new person, you don't have a lot of history. Right. A young person.
Okay. Yeah. Our last set of verses, Beth.
Then the sons of Rimeon, the Barophite, Rechab and Banath, set out and came at about the heat of the day to the house of Ishbosheth, who was lying on his bed at noon. And they came there all the way into the house as though to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach.
We're in chapter 4, verses 5 and 6 is where we are, if you lost place there. Okay, now we jump into verse 9.
But David answered Rechab and Banath, his brother, the sons of Rimmon, the names.
It's close enough, the Beerothite.
And said to them, as the Lord lives, who has redeemed my life from all adversity, when someone told me, saying, look, Saul is dead, thinking to have brought good news, I arrested him and had him executed in Ziklag. The one who thought I would give him a reward for his news. How much more when wicked men have killed a righteous person in his own house on his bed? Therefore shall I not now require his blood at your hand and remove you from the earth.
Okay. More integrity on David's part. So in verse 1 of this chapter, after Abner's death, Ishbosheth lost courage because it was Abner who was the real power behind the throne. And he knew that, Ishbosheth knew that, and he feared Abner, chapter 3, verse 11. And he probably also knew that Abner had joined with David and attempted to bring Israel under David's control. And now with Abner dead, Ishbosheth knew he couldn't hold Israel together, and he knew his days as a king were coming to an end. And all Israel, we're told, also became alarmed because negotiations to unite the northern tribes with Judah might have died with Abner. If David mounted a military assault against the north, Ishbosheth would not be able to rally and lead the troops. So we have these men, Rechab and Baanah, and they served Ishbosheth as leaders of raiding bands in verse 2, probably harassing David's army. And they believe that Abner's death and Ishbosheth's weakness provided them with a golden opportunity. By killing Ishbosheth, they would help David become king of a united Israel. And they anticipated that David would reward them with responsible, powerful positions in his court. That was a mistake. They carefully planned their arrival to be at a time when Ishbosheth was most vulnerable during the oppressive heat of the day. And there he was, taking his noonday rest, and the palace guard would be kind of at ease. And in verse 6, Ishbosheth hardly lived in this luxurious palace in the modern sense of the word, and neither was he surrounded by numerous palace guards. It was more than likely just his house that looked much like other Israelite houses, maybe a little larger, because evidently he used at least one room in the house to store the grain used to feed the royal court. We see that there in verse 6. So when Rechab and Baana entered the house on the pretense of getting grain, they didn't arouse any suspicion. They entered the king's room and they stabbed him to death, and then they decapitated him in verse 7. And then they slipped away unnoticed, and so David would soon have to deal with yet another tragic death. So in verses 9 and 10, they bring Ishbosheth's head to David, carrying it some 55 miles, by the way, expecting gratitude for having destroyed his enemy. In verse 8, they even claim to be instruments of the Lord. But David shatters their hopes. He responds by taking an oath in the name of the Lord who had delivered him time and time again, and he tells them about the Amalekite who had come to him with the news of Saul's death. You recall that story. And the Amalekite also thought he brought good news to David that would bring him a reward, but David had seized him and put him to death. So when these two Benjamites came before David, bringing Ishbosheth's head as a trophy, they testified to their guilt, and their reward would be the same as the Amalekites. The Amalekite claimed that he had dealt Saul a final death blow in battle, in verse 11, and his action might have been excused by some, but even so, David believed he was guilty of murder and executed him. Rechab and Baana couldn't use warfare as an excuse. They murdered Ishbosheth in his own bed. And even though Ishbosheth had not been anointed king, as Saul and David had, he was innocent in the sense that he had done nothing to warrant his death. So how much more would these wicked men deserve to pay the penalty for their cowardly and self-serving murder? So with Ishbosheth dead, there were no further obstacles that remained for David's becoming the king of Israel. Certainly David could have overlooked the murder and immediately seized power, but he didn't. Again, he demonstrated integrity by refusing to rejoice at his opponent's setbacks. Instead, he grieved and enforced God's law against those who sought to bring him the kingdom through violence. And God gradually brought the kingdom to David. And David continued to live with integrity. What he believed, he practiced, and what God commanded, he did. And David's living this way consistently in his faith provides an excellent example for us. He was devoted to God and he possessed integrity. How do we measure up on the scale of integrity? Do we prize the attainment of our goals above the means used to achieve them? Do we take advantage of situations that could cause others to question our integrity? To follow Christ is to follow him with integrity, and it's a great challenge for us. As we become more like Jesus, our lives will display integrity at every level. And I think it helps to be so focused on Jesus and so close to him that you have no place in your life for pettiness with others. So as we tie everything together tonight, I want you to think about, or name if you can, some factors or characteristics that can help us act with integrity at all times. You'll be surprised. I made a list of those the first time I went through this. I made a list of all those things that we have mentioned tonight. You'll be surprised at how many there are. Characteristics or factors that can help us act with integrity at all times. Let me mention a couple to get you started. Patience and ongoing trust in God. What else can you think of from all that we talked about that can help us act with integrity at all times? There's another example. I mentioned Romans 12:19 about vengeance. What did we say about that? Should we take vengeance ourselves?
Yes.
Jesse's like, yeah, we need to do that.
Vengeance is mine, say it.
Okay.
Well, Ron, I don't think we get any good characteristics if we're not relying on the Holy Spirit.
Okay.
above all, to remember our relationship with Christ and who he is and what he has done, and to know that he loves that other person too.
Okay.
And we're taught to esteem others better than ourselves.
Okay. Good.
To come into a situation with an attitude of humility rather than want my rights, which our culture is full of.
Yes.
But that's not our call. Our call is to remember who we are in Christ. To stand still and watch the Lord perform it.
Let me share the things that I've mentioned, and we'll close in prayer, the things that I had written down, and you can feel free to add anything to this if you like, but these are just some of the things I scribbled down from our study tonight and different ways that will help us act with integrity at all times. I mentioned patience and trust in God, refusing to compromise our beliefs and principles for personal advantage, leaving vengeance to God, we just mentioned. Following Jesus' direction when he talked about loving our enemies, praying for them, doing good to them, blessing them. And I might add to that where he talks in Matthew 5 about if you only love those who love you, what reward is that? You know, we need to reflect God's love by loving those who don't love us, loving the unlovable, if you will. Okay, not having any hidden agendas in our actions, treating everyone with respect and dignity. I missed this somehow. I must have missed a case study somewhere, but we didn't get to talk about this. But speaking up when others do wrong, when instead of being silent in the face of others who are doing or saying things that are inappropriate. We need to speak up and then distance ourselves from the wrongdoing. Don't speak ill of others in their absence. Refuse to rejoice at others' setbacks. And I mentioned treating everyone with dignity and respect. Those are just some of the things that I thought came forth from this study at this time in David's life. Okay. We still find him at this place where he is living and acting before the Lord with integrity and following him every step of the way. Okay. I'd like to have had more time to talk about the aspect of, you know, what to do in the face when we're in a situation where we have people who are gossiping or saying things that are inappropriate, and what our response should be to that. And I've noticed, Cliff, I think you're a good model for that. Anytime I've been with you anyway, and I'm sure when I'm not with you that people have done or said things that are inappropriate in your presence, you, in a tactful, kindly way, Christian way, admonish them as the person's need seems good to you. Not to do that. But, well, you know, which it brings up another point that whether we know it or not, people are observing our integrity or lack of it.
Right.
And so
you're probably doing something second nature to you.
Well, I guess so.
Without noticing that other people are.
So, all right. Any final thoughts?
Thank you. That's a good lesson to draw from this whole story. You can get lost in the murderous, dysfunctional family issues if you don't seek for the lesson in it and the lesson of his integrity through all of those things that happened. But
we didn't go into Mephibosheth here. This and it's going to come later. That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, I think we're going to touch on that.
David was amazing in many ways.
Well, next week, if you're doing any prep, we're going to be looking at chapter 5. And we'll be talking about David's faithful leadership. So that's where we'll be next week. We'll be pretty exclusively in chapter 5. And by the way, there are passages in Chronicles that parallel our passages in Samuel. Sometimes I'll make reference to them, sometimes I won't. But there are quite a number of parallel passages if you're doing any study of this on your own. So I can always point those out if you like. So, all right, let's have a word of prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for our time together tonight. It goes without saying, I think, here that for each of us and all of us, individually and together, we want to be together as a family of people of integrity, and we want as individuals to walk with integrity before you. I have to assume that everyone is like me, and we have to confess that there are times where we don't walk properly, uprightly before you. And thank you that you forgive us those times and you help us through them, and you constantly, in your own very gentle way, remind us that we need to walk in a way that reflects who you are. May we be sensitive to your still small voice, and when you speak to us in these ways, may we pay heed to them, that we may honor you and reflect your character in all we do. As Jesse pointed out, Lord, it also goes without saying that we cannot live in this manner without the direct love of the Holy Spirit and His grace being poured out in our lives. So we look to you for that. We trust that you will do it as we ask. And for that blessing and for your continual guidance and help in these matters, we give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.
So next week.